It is absolutely delightful that we have an old friend, Christopher Spink, who is one of the leading reporters on sovereign debt anywhere in the world, and one of the most knowledgeable voices. And he has agreed to come back and talk to us on the podcast about a recent article of his that has intrigued us for multiple reasons. But let me set out a couple of reasons why this interested me, and then maybe Chris can tell us about how he got interested in writing about this rather obscure Ukrainian state-guaranteed bond. So what interested me was not just Chris's recent article, and I try to read everything that Chris writes, but that Chris's article comes out, and then there's a significant spike in the price of this one bond. I am not attributing causality, but something seems to have happened. And so, Chris, I'm wondering whether this price spike surprised you and whether you might tell us about what got you interested in this rather obscure Ukrainian bond that at least 2 years ago, because 2 years ago is when the invasion occurs, but when Ukraine does its first restructuring, post-war restructuring, where it extends maturities, this bond is treated like all the other Ukrainian sovereign bonds and given a slight maturity extension. But now the story and the players seem to have changed significantly. So welcome, Chris, and please tell us, what got you intrigued about this?
Oh, thank you, Mitu. That's a very kind and generous introduction, indeed. Well, as you say, it's a very intriguing bond issued by Ukrenergo, one of the state-owned utility companies in Ukraine. And as you say, when the initial suspension of Ukraine's debt payments was agreed in July 2022, just 3 or 4 months after the February invasion, the utility companies, well, two of them were included in the exchange, Ukrenergo was one of them. And obviously these 2 year suspensions of payments are going to start to finish from this summer. So people have been wondering what happens next. And in the meantime, there was another company, Naftogaz, state-owned, but which wasn't included in the initial restructuring because it had already told the market prior to the invasion that it had sufficient funds to meet a payment due that summer of 2022. So it managed to agree a separate arrangement with the holders of this instrument, where I think it's fair to say that they get a better outcome than what the market is indicating other Ukrainian bondholders will receive. And the lawyer who, or the law firm, which was acting for the bondholder group involved, was the same law firm which has put out this statement, Ukrenergo, last month. Oh no, earlier this month, which has caused the bonds to rise from, you know, the late 20s cents in the dollar to the mid-30s, which is a significant rise, as you say. They basically have said in the statement that they want to see that any restructuring is done on a case-by-case basis for the state-owned enterprises, well, and particularly this bond, which is due, and not just a general agreement, which incorporates the straight vanilla sovereign bonds, because obviously there's a lot of financing and borrowing has gone on both at individual levels and at the state level from official sector sources. So in a sense, the private commercial creditors are a much smaller part of the whole amount which Ukraine now owes. So it's very interesting to see that this was put across ahead of this process.
Can we talk about the creditors and what we know about them who hold this bond? And I have to start by saying that one of the many unpleasant ironies of this whole situation is that this is a green bond as well. And I can't help but remember how Mitu and I have spent a bunch of time talking with folks who are involved in green bond issuances. And one of the things they told us over and over again was that green bonds are so wonderful because they let you tap into a different type of investor base. The buy and hold folks who aren't going to run in times of trouble because they're in it for the environmental bona fides of the investment. And I gather maybe that story doesn't quite seem to fit the present situation.
Well, it's very interesting, Mark, because the bond originated from I think a partial payment to suppliers of green energy from the wind or other alternative means to Ukraine ago. And Ukraine, like many regimes around the world, has did have a, or there still does have, although it's obviously in a very special situation at the moment, an agreement to pay quite a high rate to encourage more alternative energy to be developed. And obviously, when the Ukraine found this tricky to make payments for this alternative energy, it issued this green bond. It's not entirely clear that it all went to the green companies. I don't think it necessarily did, because in the latest accounts it says that the issue isn't solved, and some of those suppliers have outstanding complaints about this deal. But nevertheless, it was the source of the energy is green. And one would have suspected that at the beginning, a substantial amount did go into those funds who wanted to support such activity. The thing which is interesting, the firm which the law firm which put out this a statement on behalf of the bondholders, with the naphtha gas situation, the hedge, there was a hedge fund named who helped in the negotiations, which was VR Capital. Now, VR have had a history of buying distressed positions, not in emerging markets, not just in Central and Eastern Europe, but also in Africa and Latin America, and then negotiating an outcome which is better than at the price at which they bought the distressed units. I did we did ask them whether they had a position in this bond as well, but they've declined to comment. So we can't be sure that they are owners. But one would imagine that this wouldn't necessarily have been put out just by the original owners, but maybe the bonds have traded into the hands of purely financial investors, I should imagine.
So, Chris, you didn't name the law firm, but I assume from your article that you're talking about Cleary Gottlieb as the law firm. Is that right?
That's right. Their name is on the this action for the Ukraine-ago bondholders, as it was for Naftogaz. Yeah.
So is, I mean, Cleary now, and I should disclose, I used to work there many decades ago, and they have a very specialized sovereign debt practice. But this is interesting because they have for many, many years been on the side of distressed sovereigns and specialized in helping distressed sovereigns out of that distress, most famously for Greece, but for Iraq and so many other countries. But maybe they had developed so much expertise defending sovereigns that they decided, maybe it's time we change the color of our hats and use that expertise for the other side. And they are, I'm pretty sure they're on the creditor's side for at least some of the actions in Venezuela, and sounds like it's quite possible, unless we get denials, that they are working with VR Capital, and VR Capital seems like a distressed debt fund that goes after extracting additional payments from sovereigns. So is this a change in the landscape of sovereign debt operations? And is there some other law firm that is maybe taking the place of Cleary on the sovereign side, or just things are in flux?
Well, I think things are in flux with regard to Ukraine. I think it was very hard for Cleary to act for the sovereign in that particular circumstance, even from 2015 when there was a restructuring following the Crimea invasion and by
Oh yeah, I forgot they
forces.
represented Putin for many years, right?
Yes, well, certainly Russia from the time of their
Oh
domestic
yeah, it's much
default
more
in
polite to say they
1997.
represented Russia rather
Sorry, I'm
than
being too polite,
represented
yeah,
Putin. But I like to say they represented Putin because somebody makes a choice on who to represent. I'm sorry.
Well, as Louis XIV says, the state, l'état, c'est moi. So I imagine it's kind of pretty interchangeable in Russia. But and they, if you remember, Russia was the board has in a bilateral way this particular bond issued by Ukraine under the in the last days of the outgoing president Yanukovych in 2014, a $3 billion bond, which was written under English law, and then there was a debate about how that might be paid out, or whether Ukraine, as a as somebody who then had lost some of its territory to the holder of that bond, should pay it out, and that went through to the highest court in London, and throughout that process, Cleary was representing Russia, as you say. It was never kind of possible that they could, I imagine, represent Ukraine at the same time. So that, I mean, it does seem that there have been changes, and actually other of the restructurings at the moment in Sri Lanka, Ghana, and Zambia, there are other firms involved. I think that's, I suppose, well, th things evolve. What can one say?
Well, no, for us who study the market, it's interesting and exciting. It's also, it shouldn't come as a surprise, perhaps, that if you develop expertise on one side, you learn how to figure out, you learn how to use it for the other side. And if the other side is willing to compensate you better, or they become your clients, you do what they need. I mean, I'm not saying it in a, I'm saying it in an interesting way, because it seemed like these law firms would be consistently on one side or the other. And then suddenly you see a shift in the atmospherics, and then they move around. But I'm a little bit curious as to whether or not, Cleary makes this announcement saying we would like this bond to be treated differently, and the market reacts to either the announcement or some perception of underlying information in the announcement. And I'm wondering what that might be. So as I read the bond documents, Ucronegro, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it. You pronounced it so well, and I'm mucking it up. But that bond has an aggregated collective action clause. And that aggregated collective action clause in the disclosure statement for the bond offering says quite clearly, this bond can be restructured jointly with any of the guarantors, other debt that have a similar collective action clauses. Now, this is fairly standard, but it does mean that investors are forewarned that if there is a wholesale restructuring, this can be put into that mix. And the investors in this single bond will be subject to the preferences of the entire group. And I cannot imagine for the life of me that the other creditors of Ukraine want this bond to be paid a premium. So is there some secret weapon here that they think that they can get this bond? Like, why would Ukraine say, yes, we'll treat you special? And I mean, that would seem like it would piss off the other creditors. But most important, it's not going to make the official sector, or at least the European authorities who've been giving this electric company additional funds to help keep the lights on in Ukraine, they don't want their money going to pay VR Capital, whoever these wonderful people are, do they? I mean, this, what is the market thinking? Because the market, you know, I studied efficient market theory, so maybe the market has some secret information that suddenly makes these bonds worth 33% more than they were worth the day before.
The mysteries of market price movements. So, I mean, it could be, it's not clear how reflective of actual bids and offers the bond has had, or yeah, I mean, it may be on very, very few expressions of interest. So perhaps I mean, and then perhaps that is people who bought at a very, very distressed price might like to see the price go up before they then have to accept a restructuring. Maybe it's because if you buy it 20 cents in the dollar and you sell it 35, you've made a significant profit. But to your other point about the prospectus, I hadn't appreciated that it could be aggregated with the other bonds of the guarantor, i.e. the state. So perhaps that was why it was indeed kind of addressed at the same time as the state 2 years ago. That's a because that would make it quite hard, I suppose, in this circumstance for the Ukrainigo bondholders to hold out from such a process.
Yeah, I'm slow, and I need things to be very clear and explicit for my little brain to follow them. But I'm just to follow up on Mitu's question, and Mitu, maybe this is in part for you. I think the subtext here is that maybe the market is very inefficient indeed. I mean, one deeply cynical way to look at this is that the effect, if not the intent of the announcement, is to goose the market a little bit, causing some less informed folk to think that this bond really is going to get separate treatment and allow the folks who bought at super distressed prices to exit at a nice tidy profit. Is that the story? Because I can't, like me too, I can't fathom why anyone would believe that this bond is going to get separate treatment. Certainly it doesn't have to get separate treatment legally. And I, you know, if you know, I think of the bondholders' leverage as a function of what they're going to do if they don't get treated separately. And it seems to me they have very little that they can credibly threaten to do. They can be lumped in with all the other debt, as Mitu points out. And even if they couldn't, what meaningful enforcement rights do they have? So is this all, I don't know. Is my cynical story the right one?
I think you might be right, Mark. I mean, Mitu perhaps should talk more about the legal aspects and the efficient market theory of his textbooks from before. But I think we did do a separate story last year when the bonds of the sovereign were at a very low level before there was a big reconstruction conference ahead of the first IMF funding, which came in. And once that had come in, then the prices of the sovereign, they were in the teens and they're now in the kind of 20s. So there's always, you know, and I think there are far more of those. So there's more opportunities to trade those. So I think that's probably what's happened there. But is this just, I don't know, someone trying it on? Maybe me too.
Well, I don't. It may be that I haven't read the fine print carefully enough, and I will. It is quite possible that the lawyers for the most recent purchasers of this guaranteed bond have, as you would expect them to do, gone through the documents with a fine-tooth comb and have found something in there that gives them an advantage, that despite the aggregation clause, could help stop the aggregation. Mark and I have seen this in other contexts where, you know, you have an aggregation clause, but then you have something else elsewhere in the document that says, oh, no aggregation. And, you know, these kinds of goofs happen. It is also possible, and I remember seeing this early in the Venezuelan crisis, which was that the market takes signals from sophisticated hedge funds focusing in on a particular bond. Because even if that bond is not that different, the fact that there is an aggressive fund that is focusing on that bond means that everybody else who wants a disproportionate payment tries to piggyback and jump into that bond. At least that was my conjecture as to why, as soon as there was a press report that a certain fund had accumulated a position, in that case, I think it was a position that allowed them to block an acceleration, the price seemed to go up. But who knows? I mean, like Mark, I'm a little bit skeptical that these markets are highly efficient. On the other hand, they are information sensitive, and sometimes people try to react very fast before the price gets beyond them, so they can, as you said, Chris, take advantage of small price movements. But this has to be something that we're gonna dig into further. But Chris, I was wondering if we might get to the question of official money and whether bondholders, some bondholders, like for the SOEs, are thinking, look, if we can escape early without being lumped into the big restructuring, we can get paid out of official money. Is there any, are you seeing any clues as to why Ukraine would do this? I guess I'm asking a version of Mark's question again. Do institutions like VR Capital, if it is that VR Capital is the one that is holding these instruments, do they have any way of disrupting the electric company from operation that would cause them to pay? Now, I'm remembering now the Sri Lankan airline that was an SOE and with very bad documentation, they paid their bondholders even after Sri Lanka, the country, had gone into a horrible default. It was totally bizarre. Like, why are you throwing the country's money away? But they did. They were like happily threw the money away. So maybe there's just something here that they have this extra money from the EBRD or something, and they're going to pay the bondholders.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I suppose there's more specific facilities have been directed towards Ukraine from the EBRD and indeed the IBRD, the World Bank. But as much as that might make the whole company more resilient financially, it also, I should imagine, make it more complicated from a restructuring perspective, that those facilities, one would imagine, are always going to be senior to the commercial bondholders. But as you said, that it's always the state-owned enterprises. It's not, as with Sri Lanka and, you know, Venezuela with PDVSA and the Hellenic Railways in Greece, they always seem to have, people are slightly uncertain of the status of these enterprises and whether they are seen as special things which you have to keep running. So people feel that providers of capital can't be brushed off so easily as in other cases. But you know, there are other instances where it's it becomes a very tricky situation. Like, witness how in Mozambique a state guarantee was introduced on some loans to a tuna boat provider, which eventually I think has all been the guarantee was retrospectively removed. But there's always uncertainty, I suppose, in a fast moving situation.
I feel like, and Me Too has thought about this more than I have, and Chris, I'm sure you have too, but I feel like the world of sovereign guaranteed debt is this murky area of slipshod drafting practices and little attention paid to deal structure or documentation or risks. And that every time I look at a sovereign guaranteed bond, I'm always surprised by some weird aspect of it that that I can't quite figure out how it works. Here, I guess, I wanted to ask you before we move on, I wanted to ask you what has happened to the price recently. I saw that it had come down somewhat from the the little spike that it had had. And I say a little spike, but as Mitu points out, relative to what the bonds had been trading at, it was quite big. They've come down a bit, but have they come down closer to where one might expect or where they were trading beforehand?
They're still trading above where they were before this statement was put out. But the spread between the bid and offer is 36 to 39. So that would suggest there's not fierce competition to get hold of the bonds. So it would suggest that the people who put up the price at which they were prepared to either buy or sell the bonds, as they've now it's drifting back. But the Ukraine itself has not commented on what they're planning to do beyond what they've said they're trying to address the wider debt suspension as it finishes in the middle of the year.
So, Chris, we've taken up too much of your time, and we promised we would end at about 40 minutes, and we're literally a couple minutes away from there. But I wanted, as my last question, given that we're hitting the two-year anniversary of this truly horrible situation in Ukraine, there was, at the beginning, when we had the first extension of maturities, there was, at least to my perception, a lot of positive sentiment on the creditor side in the direction of helping Ukraine. Everybody was going to put their shoulders to the wheel and take losses in order to help Ukraine. And then when Ukraine went into reconstruction, creditors would get paid back at a discounted value. And I remember thinking that, oh, it's so interesting that subsets of creditors are not being greedy and demanding disproportionate payments as they might have in other contexts. And I also remember hearing that the particularly aggressive creditor funds who specialized in distress context had sort of stayed out of it because there was too much political pressure on investors to cooperate. Has that crumbled? Is that why we have particular subsets now having the courage to go out there and say, no, we want to get paid now, and good luck to you, Ukraine. Good luck with your restructuring in the future. We do think you should have a restructuring, but we'd like to get paid now and go home to our villas in the south of France.
Oh, well, it's hard for me to speculate, but I suppose that, you know, we are at that moment where people are still looking at the official sector lead and the political lead, and as you say, we have this the bulk of the financial aid to Ukraine will come in theory from the US, and this all depends on whether the lower house will support to the 60 billion aid package, which in the IMF's latest statement on its Ukraine mission says this is what is required to keep the war costs going this only for this current year. So hopefully it will only be this year when it is required. But I suppose, as we all know, there's a lot of politics to happen this year, and if things have to be done quickly, then there might be more opportunistic funds who see potential to, well, what it looks like profiteering, doesn't it, really? But from a messy situation.
It does indeed.
Yeah. But anyway, I think Ukraine's wider issues is how they're going to secure the funding, I think, at a higher political level.
Well, I, for one, hope that this gambit does not succeed. So not much to hope for, but I can hope for that. And as we wrap up, just want to say thanks again, Chris, for coming. We always love having you on the podcast and reading your stuff, and hope we can have you back on, hopefully to talk about something with a little greater tinge of optimism to it, maybe.
Excellent. That would be great. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Meaty. Always a pleasure.